This is an interview with Dr. Greg Johnson, who is being interviewed for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Collection, particularly the ACT Monero Riverina branch. The interview is taking place at his home in Aranda in Canberra on Ngunnawal land on Thursday, 19 October 2023, and the interviewer is Rosalind Burge. Greg, thank you for your time this morning for this interview for the Society. I'd like to start just with some early biographical details, where and when you were born.
I was born in Maryborough, which I think is the Bajula country in Queensland, in 1952. My parents were born there, as were three of my four grandparents as well.
Goodness, there's a strong association with that place.
There is, yes, and some of the earlier generations were there, born there as well, starting their arrivals for around 1850.
And you have Chinese heritage too.
Yes, one of those early arrivals was what we know as John Mann. He came as an indentured labourer probably in 1853, and he married a Scottish woman in Maryborough in 1863, and she had come from Edinburgh as a servant.
Did he come straight from China to Maryborough?
Those details are a little sketchy, but we think he came via Sydney, and he worked at Dugilbo, which is near Gander. He unfortunately died in about 1888, and you know, so the history of his early life has been lost. But he came from Amoy, which is now Xiamen, in Fujian province. And of course it was a family secret. My mother didn't know about it until around 2000 when her cousin told her. I knew in the 80s that that he was born in China, but I assumed he was probably the descendant of a missionary, you know, a child of a missionary or something, because he was John Mann, but Mann, spelled M-A-N, is a surname in that area, and it translates as Wen, W-E-N, in Mandarin.
You've done a lot of work researching this.
Some of it, yes, but of course it's a little hard to trace these things, but I do have a copy of his naturalisation certificate in which he is called a shepherd and bushman.
And you don't know where he worked?
Well, he worked, it said that he worked for the Walsh family in Dugilbo. His address was there at the time he married as well. But in later life, they lived in Maryborough, and at his death, his occupation was recorded variously as gardener and fruit seller. So he probably had a market garden. At one point he got fined for not having a permit to a hawker's license, so he probably might have also sold fruit and veg door to door.
And you mentioned he married a Scots woman. You've also got a lot of Scottish blood.
Particularly on my mother's side, Elizabeth Smith was orphaned. She was trained as a umbrella maker and glove maker, and that came down through the family. They were seamstresses, but it was always family law that both that person, she didn't die till 1930, was an umbrella maker, and also her daughter-in-law could make umbrellas as well. And on that's on Mum's father's side. On her mother's side, I'm descended from Scottish gardeners from Aberdeen, various generations of John Roy.
It must be marvellous to have all that history, to know your own history. You mentioned that your mother didn't know until 2000 about your Chinese forebear, but you knew in the 80s. You didn't want to mention that, or...?
Well, no, I knew in the 80s that he was born in China because her aunt had told her, but we hadn't imagined that he was Chinese. But when you look at a picture of him, his son, you can see that is Mum's grandfather, and you can see the Chinese features.
Mm, what a wonderful photograph.
That's from 1926. So he was the second son of the family.
Marvellous. What is this big building?
It's the... they were window and door manufacturers in Maryborough. I think it's Hines and Son, or Fairleys. It's Fairleys. And also my grandfather is in that picture there.
So they worked there?
They worked there. My great-grandfather worked there for over 60 years, starting as a boy of 12.
So when do you ever left?
And that is a copy of a picture that's in the John Oxley Library.
It's a marvellous, just the composition. We might include that.
And my when I spoke to my mother's cousin, she told me that... the photos were in the John Oxley Library. I ordered the photo and I puzzled over it and I showed it to my mother and she said, well, that's Grandad and that's great-granddad. And she recognised both of them, of course.
How marvellous.
And Grandad and my cousins, who are direct male line descendants, have straight black hair.
All the signs are there.
Yes.
How do you feel about having that strong heritage, both the Chinese and the gardening?
Well, it's, I'm quite happy about it. You know, when I left university, I actually enrolled
university.
Okay, so when I left university, just intuitively, I enrolled to do Chinese, but it's Chinese language, but I only lasted about 6 weeks or something. I didn't last very long. But there was obviously an interest there. Of course, I've always been interested in gardening right from when I was a child. So there must be some gardening genes. I've got no sporting genes at all.
You mentioned that on the phone and seemed very proud of that fact. Yet your father was very, very involved in the sporting community.
He was, yes. But I guess sometimes these things are a result of where you grew up, what opportunities you have. And Dad was a keen footballer. That interest wasn't there for me.
And you said your mother was a football widow, so...
Yes, that's, perhaps earlier on anyway.
So who fostered that gardening interest for you?
Well, I guess, you learn by observation and, some of my early memories would be of Mum and Dad doing gardening being allowed or given some... ground in which to grow things.
So your parents grew their own...
Well, they gardened in the way that the neat and trim era was, grew vegetables. And, of course, Dad's father was a very, very keen gardener. He was a labourer, but in their small house in Tanana on the edge of Maryborough, they had a very large vegetable garden in front of the house, in the sort of English cottage style, I guess I would have realised now. But of course, they had a double block because in earlier times they had a horse which was for the sulky. But Grandad was a very keen gardener. After he retired, he grew more And then he used to work down the road for a nursery until he was virtually till the day he died in his 80. He was about 80. Mum's father also gardened, but, you know, that was also the Depression era. Mum had a lifelong dislike of silver beet because she had her whole life's quota as a child.
And do you have any passions or distastes for things that you were forced to eat as a child?
I don't know about forced to eat, but I don't like rock melons. I used to call them rotten melons, but, you know, it's just the flavour that I don't like, but everything else I like.
And you moved around a great deal in your childhood.
Yes, well, Dad worked for Walkers. He did his apprenticeship there as a turner, but he got his hand caught in a machine. And as part of the rehabilitation, he trained as a manual training teacher. And so then we moved, as he had various posts, until we came to Bundaberg, just at the end of grade three for me. We stayed there for the rest of my high schooling. Then I went to university when I was 17. But before that, I'd lived in Maryborough, Ingham, Bundaberg, and Brisbane, and Townsville.
It's a lot of moving about. So the whole house moved, not just your father, for his work.
Yes, but it was, you know, 2 to 3 years in each place. Of course, those days, you'd be moving by train. You know, you'd have long journeys in the Sunlander. We didn't get a car until I was in about grade two in Townsville. So our latter moves were by car. Always before that, it was in the train.
And you mentioned Walkers, Greg, just for someone listening to this. What is
Walkers? Walkers is shipbuilders engineering works in Maryborough. They're still operating. Of course, Dad was working there during the war, and they were building boats. One of the boats that he worked on is in the Maritime Museum in Brisbane. It was a Corvette. I forget its name. They still continue, as far as I know, Walkers. And, of course, Maryborough is getting more business in that area, for example, manufacturing, I think, rail carriages. Bundaberg, yes, from grade three, I went to Walkervale School and then Bundaberg State High, finished school in 1969.
Do you think automatically of going to university? Because that was your next point, wasn't it?
I think my parents always, obviously recognised that I was good academically. They only thought about me perhaps becoming a teacher, and it was only when me spoke to career advisors that they suggested I could have other opportunities. I was fortunate to be awarded a state government scholarship to do agricultural science at the University of Queensland. That's how, and of course, because I was interested in gardening, that was, you know, something that attracted me.
Was the scholarship specifically for agricultural science?
The scholarships, you would apply and you would indicate your preferences. You know, my first preference was agricultural science, second preference was dentistry, and there was, I guess, some scholarships allocated for different agencies. My year was the last year to be awarded state scholarships. After that, at least in agricultural science, there were no more. Of course, there were still Commonwealth scholarships, but the job opportunities for agricultural scientists were fewer, perhaps. Don't know the reason. It could have been change of government policy, but ours was the last year, and there was, I think there was three of us in first year and another three awarded to three other boys, of course. In second year. Having said that, we had the most girls of any year in agricultural science. We had about 12 or 14 out of something like 95, and one of those had been awarded a nationally competitive scholarship.
So it was a competitive group that you were in.
It was, yes. There was a lot of very bright people in our year. Mix of people who had come from farms, people who'd come from agriculture, from, you know, country towns like me. Three of the girls in our year they went to All Hallows in Brisbane, a Catholic girls' school, and it happened that the one lecturer in agriculture, who was a woman, went to their school and spoke very glowingly of agriculture. That's how three of them decided to do agriculture.
Do you keep up with any of those people?
We had our 50-year reunion just a week ago, and I think there was 45 people graduated, and there was 35 of the graduates came to the reunion, along with, I think, about 24 partners or spouses. So there was, I think it was 69 people altogether. So it was great because people who had been good friends who I'd lost touch with, we've reconnected, and people who I'd never spoken to ever before, I know more about them now than I ever knew. But it was interesting to see what they had done, what they had experienced. And we had a discussion group on a week ago with the idea of what we would like to write something about how agriculture should be taught better based on our own experience. It's yet to be seen whether it eventuates, but it certainly was interesting to have that discussion, and each of us had written a one or two page account of our life so far, and lots of experience from all of those people.
Had they all stayed in agriculture?
Well, of course, many of them didn't ever go into agriculture because there were a few jobs, particularly the women in our year. Some of them became teachers, and then there was a variety of jobs for the men. Some people went on to do master's degrees and later PhDs. Quite a few of the women in our year did economics and farm management, and some of those came to Canberra for one or two years after they graduated, working in various departments. But the advantage of doing agriculture is that it's a very broad course and you can specialise in many things. And those that specialised in economics or farm management had opportunities to move into the broader areas of business as well.
It's really quite a huge field. And just looking at your CV, the realms of possibilities are extraordinary. You didn't stay. Well, let's not jump ahead to your work. Let's finish your university. You went to university, did ag science, and then where did you head to?
Well, I majored in plant breeding and plant pathology because within the DPI we would meet each year with the head of plant industry, Gordon Miles, and have a discussion about where our future may lie. He said there was no vacancies for plant breeders, so it was in perhaps third year it was decided that I would major in plant pathology. And I was the only student from my year to major in plant pathology, whereas there was maybe half a dozen who majored in entomology. But looking back, that was a good choice because I initially was based in Brisbane, which I very much wanted to be, and then I went out into the country.
Why did you particularly want to, you say that with great emphasis, why did you particularly want to be in Brisbane?
I guess it was because my friends from university were going to be there, so, I wanted to continue those friendships if I could. So it was a good step to have that initial experience and training in Brisbane before I went to the country.
And your extracurricular life at that time, this is the early 70s, a time of great tumult, as you mentioned, and social change. And what were some of the other activities you were involved in outside the university?
Well, you know, I guess when you are at university, particularly in a large city like Brisbane, you are exposed to many ideas and thinking. That was a time of Vietnam War protests. It was a time of Springbok tour protests. There were many people came to speak. Ralph Nader came to speak, who was very influential at that time.
Did you hear him?
Yes, I went and listened to Ralph Nader, and you know, that was a pretty seminal influence. And of course, in my fourth year, we had the Aquarius Festival at Nimbin. I went to that for a few days, and I was, I guess, very much influenced by the sort of social issues associated with the things that I heard and talked about, and also my friends were interested in, whether it ranged from, you know, organic agriculture or simpler living lifestyles to, you know, being more ecological, to things that you would think of as more spiritual, such as meditation. And I guess those things sort of just sat comfortably with me, even though I continued to work for the Department of Prime Industries, going out into the country. And when you deal with farmers, of course, the salt of the earth, but very fine people as well.
So the things that you learned or encountered at Nimbin, were they vastly different from your growing up and your family experience?
I guess there were things that my parents hadn't thought about, but of course at that time there were things also like the beginning of Earth Garden magazine. So there were things that I was reading, and of course being interested in gardening from my earliest days, it just gelled, I guess.
It has a reputation as quite an alternative in experience, event happening at that time too.
Yes, there was certainly that element of it. I was sharing a small accommodation built out of picture frame wood and tar paper, and I think there was about half a dozen of us who could sleep there, lined up, you know, in sleeping bags. My memories aren't so...
No. But I'm intrigued that you put it on your CV.
I think it's an area of history that perhaps hasn't been well enough documented. Maybe it's because many of the attendees have... I can't remember.
So you left university, and where did your first job take you?
So my first 3 years were at Indooroopilly, one of Brisbane suburbs, which was where the science laboratories of the department were located. Perhaps half of the plant pathologists in the state were based there as well. My supervisor was in charge of vegetable research diseases, and he was near the end of his career. He had been one of the very first, perhaps the second generation of plant pathologists appointed in Queensland. His name was Jack Aberdeen, J.E.C. Aberdeen.
You mentioned that that's important. You mentioned it in a way that suggested that was important. You saw yourself as part of a dynasty, as it were.
I guess you have the lineage of scientists, and in Queensland, the first vegetable pathologist was appointed in the 19th century. That was because of problems such as rust in wheat. That was Henry Tryon, and he was the vegetable pathologist appointed, as I said, in the 19th century. He subsequently appointed one person who continued that work, and he specialised in tropical fruit research, and there was that sort of knowledge and growth of understanding of how to manage these diseases. You inherit both some of the knowledge and experience of your predecessor, and you carry the story forward. So I guess that's why it feels like a dynasty. And of course, at the time I was there, Jack Simmons, who was, I guess, the second generation, as I said, was still wandering the building. And in a later time in my career, I continued some of his tropical fruit research. And his mother is named Rose Simmons, and just recently there has been an exhibition here at the National Gallery of Photography, including many of her photographs. So he came from a family who, of course, that was late 19th century, early 20th century, who were interested in the arts but also very interested in natural history.
So there must have been... What was the feeling at that time to be immersed in your career and your work in that... Yes, that stumbling question, Greg, about that whole environment.
I suppose that group of people were, you know, they were university people, they were people of science. Of course, you know, they were, perhaps some of them had come from that background, particularly those who lived in Brisbane. You know, they had been interested in things like natural history. That just fitted me, you know, that suited me. And that was the area that interested me when I had been at high school. The things that most interested me had been when we did some biology in science. You know, going out looking at vegetation, those were the things that excited me. I had a friend in high school whose parents managed a sugarcane farm that was owned by Vera Scarth Johnson, and Vera Scarth Johnson was both a botanist and a botanical artist. And even though I had very little to do with her, that was the first person I had encountered in my life who lived a life of science, I guess.
It's a lovely phrase. So where did you head to after Indooroopilly?
So after 3 years in Brisbane, I was appointed to become the tobacco pathologist in Mareeba in far north Queensland. So I transferred by train. I got stuck in Townsville through floodwaters, spent a week at the University College in Townsville before I finally got to Mareeba, and began working for 9 years on disease of tobacco and peanuts. My boss at the time was Bill Pont, who had been in North Queensland since 1953, and he was based at Kamarunga Research Station near Cairns. And I have strong memories of the first time I met him, which was hot, humid, no air conditioning, and he was a very slow person with the fan rotating slowly. You know, very much the sort of, that was that period. And of course, in those days, you wouldn't even telephone Brisbane unless it was a national emergency. And if Bill Pont was going to visit the Tablelands, which was where I was based, he would write me a note to say that he was coming next week. He wouldn't telephone either. You know, the telephone was only used very rarely. And you have your little memo book that you would write memos in.
And the post worked.
Yes, that was the end of an era, of course.
Yes.
Within that period, we got a fax machine, and, you know, we gradually entered more modern times.
But even today, a fax machine is already passé.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So how was it for you when he would come to visit?
Well, he was, you know, he was a gentleman of the old school, and if he came to the Tableland, it would be because he would be looking at or visiting a farm or doing something related to his needs, and I would sometimes travel with him to look at the particular problem. But each of us had our own responsibilities. I was responsible for tobacco, and so I was part of the team of people working on tobacco, extension, agronomy, plant breeding, and so you learn, and your priorities and what you do is influenced by that team need. The main problem of tobacco disease was a downy mildew, and at that time the fungicide now known as Rudamil was just becoming available, and so I did some of the early work. That's metalaxyl is the scientific name. Did some of the first work controlling, looking at that fungicide to control downy mildew. And, you know, of course you're working with the research team, the farm labourers, but also having some dealings with farmers. We would perhaps be doing trials on their farms. You would be visiting the farms to look at disease problems. We also operated the diagnostic service, so that myself and a technical staff member with me, Bob Davis, would need to try and work out what was the problem in that sample that was brought in, whether it was, you know, a cabbage or corn or a mango. And of course, having been in Brisbane for 3 years, where I also had responsibilities for diagnostics, I built up a knowledge memory of the cause of many of these things. But there was always some excitement, I suppose, when you diagnosed or saw a disease for the first time. For example, for seeing downy mildew on roses for the first time. You know, there's a sort of feeling, I suppose it's how medical doctors may feel, where they have that power to know that is what that is and this is what you should do. And there's also the trust. You experience the trust both from the farmer but also your colleagues in extension, because extension officers would only bring you or get you to look at the problems they didn't already know the cause of.
So the special things came to you.
Yes, and we would also get sent specimens. So we would get sent specimens. My district extended to Mackay, and in those days they would send you sometimes a specimen in a specially made wicker basket that was sent up in the train, and you'd have to send the basket back, of course, because they wanted it, but sometimes, of course, they'd come in the post and they would be not able to be worked on because they'd rotted along the way.
Were they safe in the wicker basket?
It depended on the particular specimen, but yes, it was. That was in the days when you could do things like that. I mean, when we were children, sometimes on holidays in North Queensland, we would post a coconut to our cousins in the south. You know, you would just need to write on the coconut, put stamps on it, and it would go through the post to our relatives.
You can't imagine that happening today. It wouldn't go through the machinery.
It'd be worth trying.
We just had a brief pause, Greg, but just the whole idea of that world that you were in at that time, is so different from today. So you mentioned a couple of other aspects, the air conditioning and so forth.
Yes, well, of course, I mean, many people don't even know what plant pathology is, and I remember saying to someone once that I was a plant pathologist, and she said I didn't know that plants had blood. But of course, plant pathology is the study of plant diseases, and diseases are one of the major causes of food loss, forest destruction, and damage to the environment. And so, the study of plant pathology is very important, but perhaps under-recognised. And, you know, the era that I lived in at that time was one of change. I mean, Jack Simmons, who was the first government pathologist, used to ride a horse when he visited farmers. He would go by train somewhere up into the country, then go by horse. My immediate boss would ride a bicycle when he was visiting farms. And, you know, for me, we, of course, didn't have air conditioning in our cars, and I didn't get air conditioning in my government vehicle until I made the case to the director, and it was only because of the plant specimens we were collecting that justified having air conditioning in your vehicle. Didn't matter about the humans who had to drive several hours, but the plant specimens, of course, were more important.
Was the horse a departmental horse waiting at the railway station?
I'm not sure, because that was, of course, in the 1920s. You know, they would maybe go to the local place where you got horses, hire the horse.
So you must have become very involved in the community you lived in and worked in.
Yes, I did become involved to some extent. You know, I had interest in plants, of course, and so in that time in North Queensland, particularly when we lived in Mareeba, I was in what was then the Society for Growing Australian Plants. It's now the Australian Plant Society, I think, and we did some wonderful excursions. In my earlier days in Caranda, my wife and I lived in Caranda, and you know, that was a more alternate lifestyle place for a while there, particularly as our elder son was only young. We had a stall at the Caranda markets where we would sell food that we would make on Saturday. Meanwhile, I was working in the DPI during the week in Mareeba, 40-kilometre, half-hour drive to work.
What prompted you to have the stall as well?
Well, I guess it was, you know, that meant that my wife had some independent income, but also, you know, our salaries weren't so high. We were wanting to buy a house,
So you moved out of the tobacco industry.
So after 9 years in North Queensland, in which time I had also completed my master's degree in agricultural science externally from the University of Queensland, I was applied for and was appointed as the post-harvest pathologist that was based in Brisbane. I was responsible for research to control the diseases on fruit after harvest, particularly on mangoes, because that was just the beginning of the expansion of mango growing in North Queensland, and there was interest in developing better methods to control the diseases so that the fruit could be exported. It just happened that that was also the end of the tobacco growing era. And many of the people who had been tobacco growers began growing mangoes. And so some of those industry leaders in the tobacco industry, I continued to deal with them as they became mango growers. I valued, I guess, and appreciated those connections over many years with those same farmers.
So why did the tobacco industry fall away?
The tobacco industry began to fall away because the government wanted to phase out tobacco production. The tobacco grown in Australia was mainly filler tobacco. The only really good flavour tobacco came from the tobacco growing areas in Victoria, which were more elevated. The soils, the nutrition management, and also the cool nights contributed to develop what was regarded as the flavour tobacco, which would receive a higher price. Also, there had been a period when, by law, tobacco products sold in Australia had to contain at least 50% Australian-grown tobacco. Once that restriction was removed, there was less demand for Australian tobacco. The advantage moving forward was that many of the farmers who went into growing mangoes were very aware of the importance of controlling nutrition in order to get good colour. And the mangoes grown in the Atherton Tableland, because of the cool nights, have wonderful blush. Of course, the main variety is the Bowen or the Kensington Pride mango, a variety that appeared and evolved in Australia. Around Christmas time, the mangoes from the Atherton Tableland come on the market, and they always have a wonderful colour.
It's interesting to hear you say that it only developed in that time. Some of us think that there's always been mangoes forever and a day.
Well, you know, what's been necessary has been better transport systems, the growth of, you know, the trucking industry, better roads, and cool storage. You know, the research we did in the 80s and 90s were to do with developing the best systems for marketing fruit in the south. We also had to work out measures to control fruit fly because there were prohibitions on entry of fruit into Victoria and South Australia because of the risk of fruit fly. We then went on to develop...
Just pause one moment.
Well, I was talking about the...
fruit fly.
And, you know, I was talking about the development of export protocols. We then went on to develop. We had to develop protocols to ensure that mangoes were free of fruit fly when we were exporting to Japan. The first export market that was opened up was the market to Japan.
Why was that the first?
I guess it was because it was a very high value market. There was strong interest from the Japanese also. The Japanese, we had Japanese disinfestation technology, which was like a steam heat, I don't know enough detail about that, technology to ensure the mangoes were free of fruit fly risk, but the fruit weren't damaged. We also worked on irradiation of mangoes to control that. The irradiation technologies didn't proceed to the same extent, partly because the irradiation technologies also interfered with ripening of the mango. It would stay green.
Were you involved in the marketing overseas?
I wasn't, no. Of course... that are controlling fruit fly and managing disease were only part of what was necessary. We also had to manage ripening. And there gradually emerged approaches to managing fruit and vegetables. We had quality assurance, which was to improve the whole chain from farm to market to try and ensure that the fruit or vegetables were of the best quality when they got to their destination. We've gone on now to have supply chain management, which is also about efficiencies in terms of labour, time, and care for the product, to value chain management, which is a similar approach. And these systems approaches really have become worldwide, and of course they're things that supermarkets have been very interested in. One of my colleagues in Queensland, Scotland, she was very much involved in developing what we call fresh care, and fresh care is aiming to get fruit and vegetables in the best possible state to the consumer, and also to minimise losses. And my responsibilities at that time in mangoes and other tropical fruit were really focused on the development of appropriate disease management approaches.
It's a huge business.
It is a huge business, but so much and so often people talk about we need to improve yields, we need to get more production, and therefore we need to invest in production research. But for many commodities, 30% of the product is lost after harvest. And of course, that's where the profit is, because you've wasted all of that energy and time, environment, everything that has gone into producing that product. If it actually is then lost, it's a huge waste. And even today, you will read many accounts of, research, and they always forget about post-harvest. But of course, the supermarkets and the producers, the manufacturers are very much aware of those issues.
That was a large part of the rest of your career, wasn't it?
Yes, because at that time when I began to work on mangoes, in addition to the Australian research looking at the development of our domestic and export marketing, I was involved in collaborations through the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research. The Australian Centre for Agricultural Research was an initiative of the Fraser government, and was really about doing research on problems affecting Australian farmers and developing country farmers, so that the research was funded both in Australia and the partner country. And initially that was very much in Southeast Asia, other parts of Asia, and of course the Pacific and Papua New Guinea.
And you travelled around those places in your work?
Yes, I was involved in some of those collaborative projects, and then I subsequently came to Canberra in 1995 to work for the centre, and I was involved in commissioning and managing research in post-harvest technologies. That was both the post-harvest technologies for fruit and vegetables, but also for grains. So we were responsible for, projects to do with grain drying, grain pest management, but also diseases of fruit, particularly tropical fruit, and some work on vegetables. And also then extending to supporting collaborations to do with better management of cocoa and coffee problems post-harvest in Papua New Guinea, later on in Indonesia. We were also doing a variety of work in the Pacific.
Just before, I'd like to come back to ACARE, but just before we leave Queensland, you did your PhD when you were still there.
Yes, I did my PhD in the area I was working on in mangoes. I worked on stem end rot of mangoes, developing and understanding the causes of the problem and the best ways of managing it. At that time, I completed my degree, graduated, and I did work for a brief period for CSIRO, Division of Horticulture, continuing some of that work in tropical fruit, mango work.
Where was that, Greg?
That was based at the Cunningham Laboratory at the University of Queensland, in what was then the CSIRO Division of Horticulture. I guess it was through that period that I subsequently joined ACR.
Greg, just thinking about your PhD, and you did both your degrees, your postgrads, part-time. Was that for a particular purpose?
I think perhaps it was, historical, but also quite common in agriculture, and particularly in Queensland, for people to do their degrees part-time. The management saw it as a win-win because they got more effort from their scientists and their scientists got a degree. But, of course, many of them were from an era where sometimes they had been sent away even to other countries to do their postgraduate training. And so there was an appreciation of that need and importance because, of course, these days you wouldn't be employing a research scientist who just had a bachelor's degree. These days they would have to have probably a PhD just to get a job. We were of the end of an era where we could do these things part-time, and there were some of my colleagues and friends from university went to other places, Western Australia, even overseas, to do their doctorates. In my case, I did them part-time. And, of course, when you approach postgraduate studies having had practical real-world experience, it grounds your approach to what you do in your postgraduate studies. It falls out naturally from what you're doing, but it really is something you very much own because it is an area and a proposal you develop yourself rather than being, something that your supervisor had thought up.
And was it a juggle by that time you had a wife and children?
It didn't seem a juggle at the time. It's something to do in the evenings. And of course, because it is your core work as well, it means that, you're validly spending your work time doing that while doing your other responsibilities. It didn't seem a juggle. Part of that period, I was also the treasurer of the Australasian Plant Pathology Society, and my strongest memory is of spending evenings trying to juggle the records to do with finances. And, of course, it was all on paper. There wasn't anything computerized. You had everyone's membership on a card, and they would send you a check and you'd have to bank it. It was
very old times.
Yes, that's right.
But there must have been actually thinking about doing the, as you say, have just said, doing a PhD in your core work. There must have been a fillip for you, a great tonic.
Yes, I guess so. But of course, I was the sort of person who enjoyed studying, who enjoyed, the minutiae of detail, and of course, these are the things you have to find out about when you do research. You have to, of course, also be thoroughly aware of the literature to make sure that what you're doing hasn't been done by somebody else.
You've said throughout that you're a very conscientious student. Did that come automatically to you?
I guess so. I guess it's really that, you tend to focus on the things that you're good at. I happen to be good at studying. I was going to say also that, of course, in that very busy period, I was also writing for Your Garden magazine. I was the correspondent for the Subtropics, which involved writing a monthly column, and that really helped, deepen my interest in gardening, I suppose. And I had the chance to write a few stories. I visited David Gordon, who had Myall Park in Western Queensland. Of course, the well-known Grevillea Robin Gordon is named after his daughter. It was a natural hybrid. We went out there to do the interview. My wife and younger son came. We got there. He straight away piled me into a car and set off driving around his huge property, showing me all things in flower. I didn't see my wife again until we came back for lunch. He was quite elderly, almost in his 90s at that time.
He must have been thrilled to have had you visit.
He was passionate about plants, and he explained that, of course, he was fortunate because he was a wool grower, and at that time wool was worth a lot of money, and so he was able to expend some of his profits on his real passion, which was collecting and growing Australian plants, while the wool industry helped him to do that.
How did you come to that project, working for your garden?
They advertised in the Courier Mail at the time. They wanted a new correspondent for the subtropics. I had written one article which was about growing the flowering of the night flowering cactus. It just happened that the house we were renting in Brisbane had a large night flowering cactus that flowered. I took photographs and decided to submit an article. I'd been reading your garden magazine from when I was a child, so there was always that interest. Of course, at that time, your garden magazine was the main vehicle for advertising nurseries, for getting mail order plants and seeds. I'd been getting mail order plants from when I was, you know, about 15, 14, and growing interesting and unusual seeds. That was something that I guess was part of my interest in gardening.
Had your parents received the magazine that it came across your horizon?
It would have been, because I saw it in the local newsagent. The magazines in our household would have been the Woman's Weekly, of course, and they had the gardening column by, I forget his name, but Alan Seal. So that was where I was first reading about it. And, of course, in the Sunday Mail we had the gardening column by Ray Langdon, who curiously and subsequently was my lecturer in plant pathology at the university. My father was always got Time magazine. He got many of the book offers through Time magazine. There was a whole series on Life magazine. He got Life magazine as well. There was the Life magazine and the books about Australian mammals, chemistry. Also, from when I was just in primary school, my parents bought Look and Learn. And Look and Learn was, I guess, something that helped educate children about many fields of knowledge, history, archaeology. It came from Britain, and of course there was stuff about gardening in it as well. And we would get the Look and Learn every week, and I would avidly read it.
So all those magazines coming into your house, Greg, there was a learning and scholarship that was fostered by your family.
Yes, and also in my later years in high school, we were part of the extension service of the State Library in Queensland. And the extension service allowed and sent each week by train books that you were interested in. And you would just express what you were interested in generally. I was interested in architecture, house design, and things to do with animals, I guess, pets, gardening. And each week you would get, wrapped in brown paper and string, some books. And then every Saturday morning my father would take them back to the railway station and they would go back to Brisbane. And then he would pick up the following week's books. That was a wonderful service from the railway and the State Library.
For all of regional Queensland?
Yes, all of regional Queensland, I guess.
Was there a thought at one point that you considered dentistry?
Well, of course, the only reason why I thought about dentistry as a career was I had the idea that I would work 3 days a week and garden the rest of the time. You know, on reflection and knowing people who did gardening, who did dentistry, I'm glad I didn't. And, you know, in grade 10 when we did frog dissection or toad dissection in science, I almost passed out. You know, I had to walk outside, and so I knew that, that nothing to do with blood was ever going to be in my career path. I did do human physiology for matriculation. That's because I couldn't do biology. It wasn't available. It was the only thing that was close to science of, you know, my interest.
What other subjects did you do? Do you remember?
For my senior year, I did English, Maths 1, Maths 2, Chemistry, Physics, and Human Physiology.
Very much a science.
Yes, it was the class where if you were going to do science at university, if you were going to do engineering, you would have had to have done technical drawing. But I had not done technical drawing since grade 8. I had no interest in being an engineer in any case. So
there was a presumption in your schooling that the students would not automatically leave school and get a job locally, that there would be tertiary education to follow.
Yes, I mean, that was the period under the Gorton government. The Gorton government offered scholarships from grade 10 for the last 2 years of high school. We did the Commonwealth scholarship exam in grade 10. I was the recipient of one of those scholarships, as were many of my friends. It wasn't very much money, but it was just an initiative of Gorton government to encourage more people to continue. You know, of course, quite a lot of children still left school at 15 at that time, but there was still a lot who went on to do to their senior, their matriculation.
So coming back to you, we might just wind up with this section, but coming back to Brisbane and leaving Brisbane for Canberra, how did you feel making that move?
Well, I guess, you know, I felt very positive about working for ACR. We came down here in spring, September, before we moved. So my wife and younger son were also happy to be moving. The idea of living in a cooler, elevated climate appealed to us. My wife's mother lived in Sydney. So it was also, you know, something that was good for her in her own work. She'd finished studying journalism in Queensland and it was just at a time in her life where moving to other areas of employment fitted. Our elder son was already at university in Brisbane. He stayed there. So it just fitted naturally. You know, it was the feel of what was going to be right.
And your wife, as Leslie Watt, wrote in your garden as well.
She helped contribute to just one or two articles. We contributed to a book on vegetable growing, and she helped do some of the research. When we lived in North Queensland, she'd worked as a journalist. Part-time.